The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Stop the count. It's time for another Flat Chat. If you, like many of us, have been eagerly awaiting that moment when we say 2020 can do one, joy is at hand because the December 2020 edition of GP Racing is on the newsstands now. And subscribers, of course, will have been enjoying their copies for several days now. We're now officially working on January 2021, but let's not get ahead of ourselves just yet. Joining me to whiz through the delights of the latest GP racing and everything that's happened in that brief but busy interregnum between us pressing Apple P and it arriving on the doormat are Mark Gallagher and Ben Anderson. Hello, Ben, from somewhere to my east, I think, and to the north, way on the borders of Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire. Sir Mark Gallagher, as it says on my screen.
Thank you very much. Very nice to have been invited along. And I'd like to award you something as a result of my newfound status, which I've given myself. Are we going to talk about knighthoods today?
Well, we have to, won't we? I mean, we shouldn't speculate, but, you know, it's about time, isn't it? And, in this issue, we do have a one-to-one interview with Lewis Hamilton, the newly crowned world champion, seven times, and now indisputably the most successful Grand Prix driver of all time by wins, etc., etc., even if you want to go down that the long and winding debate of whether he's the greatest of all time. Some people say yes, and people say no. We've only got an hour to spare in this podcast, so we shan't be debating that one. Lewis is certainly someone who's still growing as a professional and as a human being. And he's got a lot to say about that in this interview, which Alex Kalanorkas, of course, did face-to-face. No Zooming or Microsoft Teamsing. We sent Alex into the FIA's magic airlock to speak to Lewis masked face to masked face. And it's an interesting interview, isn't it? Of course, mag deadlines notwithstanding, we had to do it before he actually got the world championship over the line. But he said a lot about, you know, the challenges involved in staying at the top, and also the energies he's had to expend, the distractions he's had, and how he's refocused this season.
Yes, it was a quite thoughtful interview, I thought, that Lewis gave. I mean, that's been the kind of standout aspect, I think, of his personality and evolution over the last few years as a character. He seems even more thoughtful, but also prepared more to say what he thinks, what he feels, and use his position in Formula One as a platform. Perhaps one of the most revealing things about the interview is that he kind of almost sees Formula One as the least important thing he does now. And it's really providing him the impetus to do all these other things that he spent, I think, his lockdown 1.0 thinking long and hard about. How can he use his voice and his profile to change things for the better, to give opportunities to younger people, to fight for racial justice and equality of opportunity and all these things that he's been campaigning on this year. And that's been his major focus. And it's been a big challenge for him. He admits that it's been very draining and added massively to his workload and been perhaps more stressful than trying to compete for this seventh world championship, although obviously I guess it helps that the car has been so dominant this year that the battle for the seventh world championship hasn't been quite so intense as maybe it might have been had Red Bull and Ferrari been in the mix. But yeah, it's great to have Lewis in the magazine. You know, it's a rare opportunity to speak to him one-to-one. Good job that Alex did. And the most fiddly thing we had was trying to put together that collage of pictures from his 92 victories up to yes. the Portuguese Grand Prix, making sure they were no repeats. And on first round, there were several repeats and some missing. And it took quite a lot of labor intensive checking, rechecking and picture searching to get that one right. So hopefully we succeeded.
It's amazing how those tiny little bits of magazine craft are often the most laborious, aren't they? Because, you know, as surely as eggs don't bounce, if we'd got a picture out of place, someone would have spotted it, even though a lot of them are quite thematically similar. And you know, there's pictures, but back in the old days when pictures were on transparency, they used to be mislabeled all the time, routinely. And so you'd be bent over a light box with a loop, as I believe they were known, trying to work out what it actually was. In the digital era, it seems to be no better. You sort of the number of times Mercedes Andy Cowell has been mistaken for the chap who looks just like him within Mercedes, because some photographer or Digitech has gone, well, that's Andy Cowell, put it into the database, and then whenever you search for Andy Cowell, this bloke who looks so like him that they actually did swap passports once.
Is that true?
It yeah. is. Well, Andy Cowell says it is. Can we have China of all places? They might never have left.
And unfortunately, if we make these mistakes, they end up in print for eternity. We can't go back into our digital CMS and correct them. So we have to go through this process and make sure it definitely is Andy Cowell every time.
God, you really made life difficult for yourselves. You could have just put his first victory and his last victory. Instead of that, no, we'll do all of them. I mean, you really...
Well, credit goes to our art editor, Frank Foster, for the genius decision to do it. But it was a good move because I think it adds quite a lot to the visual impact of the feature, and of course helps give you an instant summary of just how successful he's been, and of course still counting, because that only goes up to 92, and I think we're at 94 now, aren't we?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting interview. The thing that interesting, I think, for the breadth of topics that you can cover with Lewis, because there's so much that he does. So it's quite a long interview, but it covers a huge amount of ground. And, you know, Alex is talking to him about his Extreme E project. He's talking to him about, you know, the Black Lives Matter campaign. He's talking to him about all the different things. And actually, when you stand back and you look at 2020, for most of us, it's involved staying at home, not doing a great deal, not traveling. I mean, look at Lewis's year in 2020. He started off with, you know, campaigning against promoting environmental sustainability with the fires in Australia, and then he was, you know, flying all over the world in January and February. Launched his did a Tommy Hilfiger launch of his latest collection, his spring collection for Tommy Hilfiger. Then nips off, wins the Formula One World Championship again for a seventh time. Does a few other advertising campaigns in the middle of that, including for Vodafone. And then he's doing all this campaigning, and, you know, not just for one thing. You know, he hasn't got a singular focus in terms of his campaigning. So it's not just Black Lives Matter, it's environmental sustainability, it's promoting veganism, and, you know, it's lots of different things. And I think this is why some people find Lewis hard to take, because they kind of think, gosh, is he preaching at us from all these different angles? Actually, what again comes across in the interview is authentically, it's what he cares about. Well, these are the things that he just cares about, and he's using his platform to really find his voice. And I think this has been the year that he's done that. And maybe especially because it's been the global pandemic year, he's had time away, just like all of us, in March, April, May, and June. He's had an unusual break from racing, and he seems to have come back stronger from that, as Valtteri Bottas has found out. Singularly difficult year for him, because Lewis has just seems to have moved to a different level.
Yeah, Bottas 3.0 needs an upgrade. I think we were discussing the Autosport podcast the other night whether we need a Bottas 4.0 next year.
Yeah, it's a tough one. That I did a podcast with Mika Häkkinen at the beginning of the week, and Mika is part of Valtteri's kind of support team and management, and he's known Valtteri a long time. And
does he hold the hankies to wipe the tears?
The tears. I think particularly Turkey was something else. I mean, I think the moment when we realized he was about to lap, Lewis was about to lap Valtteri, you could feel for Valtteri, and not only does he lap him, but he waves to him as he goes by, in a kind of very friendly, but kind of see you later kind of way,
You mean salt in the wounds kind of friendly way.
And you can only imagine that Valtteri, must really feel the pressure that has come with that role. So, on the upside, he's a Mercedes Formula One driver, earning a good salary, drives the best car in the world, won a couple of Grand Prix this year. On the downside, he's had some pretty tough weekends where he's had to come to terms with the fact that Lewis has, to use James Allison's word, a metronome-like ability to just keep knocking in the successes. And I think we'll all remember that to clinch that seventh World Drivers Championship, he did it in the finest fashion imaginable and quite frankly made everyone else look slightly second rate.
Yeah, there's none of this business of doing the least possible to score. He could have just trickled along in third place, not even finished on the podium, and that would have been it. And I mean, he properly took that race, didn't he? I know he didn't actually have to overtake that many people because, as I was saying to Ben when we were talking about how we were actually going to fit the race report into the 900 allotted words that will actually fit onto the page, Vettel pitted out of his way. Obviously, Lewis had to overtake Perez, who was starting to struggle on the tyres, but it was that racecraft of watching Vettel pit in front of him and to have the presence of mind and the experience to say to himself, well, actually, no, Sebastian's done the wrong thing. I'm going to stay out. I think I can make a go of these tyres. And that was the platform on which he built his race. It wasn't just being blisteringly quick when he needs to be or throughout the course of an entire race. It's that experience, that ability to even override calls from the pits who are wanting to play it safe and say, we're just going to do a safety stop for more tyres. And he's gone, well, no, I've seen the state of that pit entry. I'm not going to do a David Coulthard Adelaide 94 or whatever it was. So
95.
Or Adelaide 95. A George Russell, a Turkey 2020 and shunt at walking pace on the way in.
Or even do a Lewis Hamilton China 2007.
Well, yes. I mean, exactly. And that was the thing, wasn't it? He did what his team told him to that day ended up spinning his wheels in the gravel.
Yeah. The interesting thing I found about Turkey was that we all get to that point, I think. Everyone's guilty of it. You watch these guys doing what they do and you kind of think, oh, I could probably do that a little bit. I'd be quite good at that, Then you see a wet Formula One race or a wet dry Formula One race, and you start to think, no, I really couldn't do that. There's nothing about that I could do. You see mixed conditions. You see Lewis Hamilton in the closing stages of the race on intermediates that are now slick from shoulder to shoulder, but there's a little bit of tread left on the shoulders of the tires. And you see him. I mean, there was one point that there was a clip of him. He pulled out to overtake the back marker, and he went through a puddle. And I thought to myself, he must have so much confidence in that car. He knows that he's not going to lose it through that puddle. Everyone else is spinning off, making fundamental mistakes. Max Verstappen, really bad day at the office for Max in terms of the way I think we've seen a slightly overly aggressive Max in and out of the car this year. And it's not doesn't bode well for the future, because we really don't need Max to become more like his dad as he ages. We need him to become less like his dad.
Dear Lord, yes.
We need him to become more like his mum, actually, which is, I suspect, where a lot of the positivity comes from, but in Max's life. But the reality is that, we saw so many examples of poor outcomes with Lewis and his evolution of those intermediates into the slicks that they became. And as you say, turning down the call from the team saying, you've got plenty of time, you could come in and have a stop. He knew that he just needed to get through those last three laps, and he had complete confidence to do so. And again, when I was talking to Mika, I said to him, how difficult is that? And Mika was saying, think about intermediates is that you know, you have to manage where you're braking so well and how hard you brake, because you want to actually brake as hard as possible in intermediates to keep that energy and the temperature up. But it's so easy to overcook it, which is why, you know, you can end up off in that, in the trap or over the curb, or, and then all of a sudden, if you hit a curb, it can become a spin and it all gets totally out of control, as Valtteri found out. But, you know, Lewis, master of his game, and he did it in fine fashion. It was a race to remember, and very timely that you've got this interview with him. Alex has done a good job.
You could see how clever he was being as well. That's the thing that really stands out about Lewis now, with all that experience and all that knowledge he's gained over the years, and particularly how on it he's been since 2016, when Rosberg pipped him to the championship and he was furious at himself and things behind the scenes. He hasn't really lifted off the throttle pedal since then. And in a race like Turkey, you could see from the onboards him going through turn eight, drivers like Magnussen, even Max, really gung-ho through there as the grip improved, trying to make up time. Lewis was going tiptoeing through that corner and even said afterwards, deliberately saving the car, saving the tyres, knowing that it's a long game, and the more that he can protect everything when the time is right, then he'll have a pace advantage and he can pay it home. Whereas a driver like Max, as good as he is and as much as it looks like he might be the guy if the car's there to threaten Lewis before Lewis stops, still has some way to go to kind of have that maturity of seeing the race as a big picture event. You know, he had that, it all started with not getting pole, didn't it? You know, he should have had pole. He couldn't really understand why the pace went away in Q3 and he got beaten by Stroll, and then he makes a terrible start, and then he's always playing catch up, but he was overreaching to catch up that race rather than letting it come to him. Whereas Lewis, even when he has a setback now, he just stays calm. And the start of that race for Lewis was terrible. He was going off the track. He lost places on the first lap, struggling with the brakes, complaining about them, but he manages to kind of ingest all of that and turn it into a positive result in a way that few other drivers, and perhaps no other drivers now, can.
And he didn't look like he was flapping either, whereas Max looked ragged from the minute he had that terrible start. Looked like the car went into anti-stall, certainly from the onboard. It just looked like that caused something to snap inside him, and he was flapping. He lost track position, and that caused him to be impatient. And that sort of needless shunt he had behind Perez was because he was too close. And it was one of those things where you could tell that in his brain he was thinking, if I don't get past now, it's never going to happen. There's sort of a fundamental lack of patience there, which, you know, fair enough, he's an exciting driver, but he's also a young man in a hurry, and some days these things come back to bite you, don't they?
Yeah, and as Lewis once was, of course, you can see a bit of the early Lewis in Max now, can't you? And it'll take time for Max to evolve into the sort of driver Lewis is now, which he looks almost unbeatable, especially in that kind of car and with that level of team around him who just leave no stone unturned every time they go racing.
There's an interesting parallel, actually, between what you said there, Ben, about Lewis through turn eight and 30 years ago, the summer of 1990, Ivan Capelli nearly pulling off one of the great upsets of all time, leading the French Grand Prix. And they put that together because before the race, they worked out that they would be able to get track position if they didn't make a pit stop. So they set the car up so that, knowing that it's a tricky place to overtake at. And what they did was set the car up so that he could kind of coast through Seines, which is the long right-hander at the end of the Mistral Strait, which is the one that puts most pressure on the outside left tyre. So, of course, it's the outside of the left tyre, the front left particularly. And so they set the car up so he could just coast through there, keep track position, and not have to come into the pits. And that's how they nearly executed one of the great upsets of all time. Just a shame he had a Judd engine and the oil pump nearly fell off, which I think was what happened in the end. But it's about guile, really, isn't it? Sometimes playing the long game does play to your advantage.
Strange to think that Lance Stroll now has more pole positions this year than Max Verstappen, which is a kind of unexpected outcome, because, you know, Max
would be furious about that.
Yeah. Jacques Villeneuve's pretty furious about it as well, as he's no longer the he's no longer the last Canadian to have a pole position. But the Max thing is beginning to concern me, because I mean, guys, even when you're listening to the two of you talking about Max, and, you know, he's no longer a young kid anymore. I mean, he's been in Formula One for over half a decade, and he's in need of that breakthrough. And the breakthrough isn't quite happening at Red Bull, because Red Bull isn't quite happening in terms of its own breakthrough. And I fundamentally believe that while there's a lot of discussion about why are Mercedes-Benz so dominant, we need to also have much more conversations about why are the other nine teams so heavily compromised by the way they approach Formula One. And actually, if you look at every other Formula One team, it's not difficult to see why Mercedes is so good, because they have everything in-house, which Ferrari do, but they have everything in-house with an incredible leadership and a very strong team, which Ferrari don't have. So there's the stability that's been there has really paid dividends. Red Bull have this. I'm very worried about Red Bull. I think, you know, we may never see Red Bull win a world championship again, because, you know, Dietrich Mateschitz is 76. Helmut Marko is 77. Adrian Newey is into his 60s now. The leadership in that team hasn't, the senior leadership in the team hasn't changed for 16 years. Not many Formula One teams have had the same leadership team for 16 years. And by the way, I'm not saying Christian Horner needs to go, but what I'm saying is, you know, does Christian need more support? Is there a way in which they could structure things differently? And then you have this fundamental problem. I know we're going to talk about sort of my column on the engines a little bit later on, but the, you know, with Honda pulling out. But given the choice between owning two Formula One teams and owning one Formula One team that has its control over its own engine program, I'd rather have one team with control over its own engine program, because Red Bull are not going to beat Mercedes-Benz thrashing around looking for customer engines and splitting itself across two teams. The two team, I've puzzled about the two team approach for a long time. If it ever did have a political dimension to it during the Bernie era, you know, having two teams out of 10, that's gone. That's gone now. So I don't really see the point of having it. And I think, you know, Dr. Marco's philosophy, whatever that is, has proven to be fundamentally flawed, because they've actually ended up with a one-car team in Formula One. You know, we're going to talk about the Gasly interview in a moment. I mean, people are saying, why wouldn't Christian Horner take Gasly back? Why would Gasly want to go back to Red Bull Racing?
That's a good point.
Because actually, it's so much better to be the number one driver in a midfield team where you can be the challenger, most likely upset the big guys, than being a big guy who can't win. I mean, Valtteri Bottas was in better shape driving a Williams, and, you know, putting in the odd amazing success. In reputational terms, he was in a better position as lead driver at Williams than number two to Lewis. It's incredibly harsh business. I think Valtteri is still a fantastic driver, but, you know, the fact is that he doesn't have the beating of Lewis, whereas he might have, you know, as with Sergio Perez finishing second for Racing Point in Turkey, that feels like a victory to them.
Mm. And Red Bull could have had a 1-2 in Turkey, couldn't they, very easily?
They could have had a 1-2 in Turkey, but they didn't. And this is why I worry about them, because when the opportunities present themselves, when a team as strong as Mercedes has an off day, and we all thought they were going to have an off day in Turkey, you need to be opportunistic and just grab that victory. That should have been an absolute victory for Red Bull at the weekend. So they lost it, every bit as much as Lewis grabbed it. And it is concerning.
Yeah, the bigger picture is quite interesting. I suppose the only counter argument is the prize money aspect. If you've got two teams in the pool, then you can double your money if that second team can be competitive. But I mean, Toro Rosso haven't had the greatest results in the Constructors' Championship over the past 5 years or so. They've been improving. And this year's obviously been reasonably strong, but it probably doesn't outweigh the amount they have to put in.
No, and I think
operations running. So,
and you see, again,
it's arguable, isn't it?
This is really interesting point that you make, Ben, because if that was true, let's say they want to have double the prize money essentially coming in, then they're in Formula One for the wrong reasons. Because if their priority is getting two sets of prize money, did they just want to turn up and participate? That's not the Dietrich Mateschitz that I met back in 2004. When he came in, he said, we want to win the Formula One World Championship as Red Bull. We want to be a top team. Here we are 16 years later, and whether Seb Vettel's career is on the wane or not, is Red Bull Racing's career on the wane as a championship winning team? They need to surge back to form, and you know they are the kind of they're the team that has been snapping at Lewis's heels to some extent this year, but not really, because anytime there's a straight fight, America's got the legs of the Red Bull, you know, pretty substantially, and Lewis has been able to get away, to just pull away. And Max is upset, it seems. You know, he's a bit upset, almost a bit rattled with the fact that he's not able to compete on equal terms. So
he says not, though, doesn't he? He keeps saying that, you know, I'm driving one of the best or the second best Formula One cars in the world. I can get on the podium every time. I just want to do my best every weekend. I feel like when he finishes a clear third and the rest of the pack is miles behind and he's either beating Bottas or keeping the second Mercedes honest, then he feels that way because he's doing an amazing job. And reputationally, to use your word from earlier, that does good for him. But on a weekend like Turkey, when Mercedes, no, they were having an off day, actually up until lap 30, they were having an off day. And Lewis just, you know, produced his bit of clever magic and, you know, used his patience and guard and everything else we've talked about to bring it home as others kind of fell apart. That was Max's race to win from Friday practice onwards. And then you see that veneer crack when the missed opportunity's there and he has a chance to turn a sort of clinging on third place into a comfortable win, and he hasn't taken it. And also his own errors have contributed to that failure to take it. Then you start to see the frustration come through and the realization that he's not in the position to maximize the ability he feels he has and achieve the results he feels he deserves. And I mean, we addressed this in the October issue, didn't we? This idea of Max's date with destiny, and he missed the opportunity to become the youngest world champion. And within that feature, we touched on the idea of Red Bull as a potentially spent force as a championship winning team. Obviously, there are elements of that team that are still really strong. And the pit stops they routinely produce are the fastest ever. You know, their ability to rebuild the car when Max crashed on the lap to the grid in Hungary was unbelievable. Strategically, they can still pull out masterful strokes when needed. Obviously, they have one of the greatest car designers ever in Adrian Newey. But you wonder, as Mark was mentioning, if the team culture has evolved sufficiently and the personnel have evolved and refreshed enough to keep them at the cutting edge. You know, a team like Williams, we've also mentioned, for so long, so successful, but they finally realised many years later that actually the culture had become a bit stale and the methods and the ways of approaching Formula One had become stale because they harked back to an era that had long since been, and they hadn't really been able to get with the times. Here and there, they'd been able to touch at it, but you need to be able to somehow, and it's not easy, of course, you know, Mercedes have kind of raised the bar. How do you copy that model or do it your own way? It's not easy, but teams are trying, aren't they, to refresh themselves. McLaren have gone through a big cycle of massive failure and final realization that they need to kind of change everything and start again and try and build back to the front. Ferrari have the infrastructure and the resources, but you know, no stability because there's just been chaos behind the scenes, not all of their own making, of course. And Red Bull, very stable, but that was a winning operation 10 years ago, wasn't it? Not now. And maybe it's difficult when you're so close and you're still winning races regularly. You think, well, we don't need to change too much because, of course, the risk of changing too much is that you throw everything out and you end up much worse off. But I don't know. I think maybe we still need to give them a benefit of the doubt. I mean, this feature in October also dealt with the fact that, you know, they produced what they felt was a really good car in winter testing. And then they used the period before the shutdown and the period during the pandemic enforced shutdown to think up new developments and new updates for the car. And I think they just outdeveloped themselves, didn't they? I think Christian Horner mentioned they were on iteration 5 or 6 by the time they got to Austria. And they didn't really understand fully iteration 1. And I feel they just got themselves a bit lost. And by the time they've worked out the path back through that mess to iteration 1 and worked out what they need to fix to get back to a proper iteration 6, half the season, three quarters of the season's yet again is gone and they're out of the title fight. So really the key for Red Bull is to start a season strongly. It's been so long now since they've, for various reasons, in the early years of the hybrid era, it's been the Renault customer engines letting them down. Since the 2017 rule change, it's been problems with their own kind of aerodynamic development and correlation and various other things that haven't quite worked out. Perhaps, you know, trusting some of the lieutenants under Newey to lead the project hasn't always worked, and he's had to step in sometimes, but they've never hit the ground running. They're always playing catch up, and they do it fantastically. And then we get to this back end of the season and they're, okay, this year's a bit of an exception, but usually they're right in the fight. They're suddenly winning races. They look like title contenders the next year. They talk themselves up in the winter, and then they go back to missing the point in the early races. So really next year, with the stability of regulations, okay, there's some tweaks that will be needed enforced to slow the cars down. But with a solid package that they understand, hopefully they can finally take the fight to Mercedes and Lewis. But I mean, it doesn't look likely, does it? And history would tell you that they've missed the boat, but we can but hope that we see the Red Bull of old next year before the cars change again dramatically in 2022.
It's funny, isn't it, that pressure of competition pushes some people in the right direction and other teams don't quite sort of put it together, because obviously in this issue we do talk about, well, the fastest Formula One car of all time, the W11, is the record breaker, set the average lap of over 164 miles an hour at Monza in the hands of Lewis Hamilton. And, you know, up until Kimi Raikkonen reset that benchmark 2018, that was a record that had stood since 2004, the benchmark of the screaming V10 era, when the engines were in theory a bit more powerful, certainly more peaky,
particularly the BMW engine that Montoya had.
Yeah, but those are the days when you could, I think they're only just, if memory serves, they're only just beginning to bring in that one engine per weekend rule. Once again, much to the chagrin of teams who said, well, but we always put new engines in for Sunday, that sort of thing. You know, we have to do this thing because we've always done it. It's the best thing to do because we've always done it. But, you know, the reason that Mercedes are so dominant this year is that partly, you know, they had a scare this time last year, didn't they? And Ferrari were coming up even if it was with an engine that people perhaps now know was not quite massively legal. Chief designer John Owen says in our feature that, you know, you can't get caught up in thinking that someone else is doing something dodgy and isn't getting caught, because that can just send you in the wrong direction. That notwithstanding, they did commit to bringing all sorts of innovations to the W11. And by the time Ferrari were pegged back, it was kind of too late to revert back, as one of our ex-colleagues would say.
Only Ferrari could manage to do the opposite of sandbagging.
Yes, exactly. So it's Ferrari's fault that Mercedes are so
dominant. I mean, so normally you're supposed to not be that good and lure the opposition into a false sense of security, and then you nail them. In Ferrari's case, they kind of showboat. Mercedes go into full overdrive to become even better. Then you get your technology banned, and then you end up looking like
mugs.
The mugs. Yeah. So I actually. What is the opposite of sandbagging? Is it floodgating?
Floodgating.
You know,
it would be showboating, wouldn't it?
Showboating.
You nailed it with showboating, because you'd be on the sea going, "Hoo, look at me! Look how fast I am!"
It's like in rugby, the swan dive, as they call it, or the ash splash, as it's also known, where you leap over the try line with the ball just sort of propped between in the palm of your hand, and you have both arms outstretched, and very often
you let go of the ball and it bounces off the turf, hits you in the face, and you don't try.
The TMO does not need to be involved in presiding over whether you had control over the ball when it hit the ground. It was very much like that. Yes.
Yeah. It was, I mean, the relentless nature of Mercedes' quest for success. Every interview you watch with Toto Wolff, every interview you listen to or watch with James Allison, you know, they're all communicating the same thing. You know, we have this relentless internal quest to beat ourselves. If we keep beating ourselves, we're definitely going to beat the competition. And, you know, the fact that they don't have the blame culture that you see in a let's say, in a Ferrari team over the years. I spoke to someone recently, you know, worked at Ferrari, and he was just talking about the change in leadership that's occurred in the last decade. You know, that, you know, we were talking about the return of Stefano Domenicali to Formula One.
Feature about him in this very issue.
There you go. And maybe that's why I was talking to someone who worked at Ferrari with him. But we were talking about the fact that the culture jaws change with each leader. And it may not change totally, but it'll be tweaked in some way. So, you know, now obviously they've got Mattia Binotto. But the reality is that there's a lot to be said for stability, but you also need that injection of fresh ideas. So I think going back to Ben, to your point, I think you're right. You know, Red Bull, of course, is still a great team. But I think somewhere between that 16-year stability that they've had in the senior leadership and you know, Ferrari's habit of changing direction fairly frequently, there's a happier medium. Mercedes seem to have that. And the W11 is just such a fabulous, fabulous car. And, you know, something we haven't mentioned from the Lewis Hamilton interview that we were talking about earlier on is, you know, when Alex talks to Lewis about the fact that Mercedes agreed to re-livery the car black for this year, and how he was just totally blown away by that. The W11 now takes on a huge significance in the history of Formula One, not just for what it's achieved in terms of its speeds and its performance and Lewis's seventh world championship, but also representing 2020 and the complexities of 2020 in terms of, you know, the global pandemic and Black Lives Matter, and, you know, with Lewis's with Lewis's love of American culture, you know, you're going to look at that black W11 in years to come, Stuart, and you're going to think of Donald Trump barricaded in the White House, refusing to come out, despite the fact that democracy has spoken.
I'm glad I said stop. Managed to say stop the count successfully earlier without falling into John Inverdale spectacles territory. By the way,
it's not your house, Donald. You have to give it back.
Yeah, yeah.
If I could drag us away from Donald Trump, although he can remain
Please
in
do.
The background,
Please
because
do.
He is the epitome of having a complete chump at the top and all the people around him having to mitigate.
Sorry, did you say chump?
Yes, I said chump.
Yeah, sorry, I wasn't sure which C word it was. There we go.
But you know, he's surrounded by people who have to mitigate the madness and make these things work. And I think what's made Mercedes so successful is this ability to do teamwork, and that there's none of that blame culture or madness. And the painting the car black is in many ways the epitome of that, because changing the colour of a Formula One car is not just a question of painting it a different colour, because the paint has a certain weight to it. You know, Mark, you were part of the Jaguar machinery. They famously had an issue with the...
Please don't bring that up.
Wasn't it the Ford people had a particular...
Sorry. Can I just correct you and say I present that as I was part of the transition to Red Bull Racing. I never mentioned Jaguar Racing because
At least there was a transition, an orderly transition.
An orderly transition.
There was an orderly transition.
Yeah, What's-his-face didn't refuse to leave.
Well, Tony Purnell.
Tony Purnell.
Yeah.
Stop the count. I will not leave my office.
Yeah, I won the election.
Yeah. Well, actually, maybe that's what Joe Biden needs to do. He needs to phone Dietrich Mateschitz, because Dietrich just sent the lawyers in and dragged everyone out. Who wasn't required from this day forth. It was pretty unseemly, but there we go.
Spin the P45.
Yeah.
Well, the teams have their own paint shops, don't they? Very closely guarded secrets, these dens within the factories. You can't go into the Red Bull one and see what they do, because it's, even though it just seems like a corporate job, the paint scheme is part of the development of the car, the weight of the paint and how the car moves through the air, all these things they take into consideration. So if you're going to change your color scheme at the last second, that's a whole feedback loop in terms of that part of your team having to come up with the calculations and work out what the weight saving is or the weight gain is if it's a
different type of coat you need. And I'm not a paint expert, obviously, but I know this is a serious piece of engineering, just like the rest of the car. It's not just a case of clicking your fingers and going, we want it black now.
You know, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, you know, this definitely time has moved on, because my former colleague at Jordan, Ian Phillips, former editor of Autosport, of course.
Twice.
I'm pretty sure I have this stat right. So he told me that at San Marino Grand Prix 1993, I think, the two Jordan cars between them had 306 decals on them. They'd literally done everything, including free pasta from a local restaurant in return for Trump. And I mean, it probably added up to a weight penalty of, 16 kilos. And that didn't include the pasta that was inside Rubens Barrichello and Eddie Irvine. Incidentally, Montoya's record around Monza, considering he was a big fan of McDonald's, that was even more impressive.
But I find it extraordinary that these cars are capable of beating the records, because they're pretty fat themselves, aren't they? You know,
they've put on a few kilos, haven't they?
And Mercedes in the early years of the current general rule set were really struggling with the weight. You know, I remember the car, I think it was pre-season 2017, was falling apart when they were testing at Barcelona, because they tried to build things light to save weight and they had to beef it up, make the car overweight. And Lewis had battles with his weight because of that, a lot of pressure on the drivers to save kilos because the cars have got so unwieldy. And then when you add in the problems of the control tyres that can't take the loads, and you add in the fuel flow limits and all the rest of it, the fact that they're able to find levels of performance hitherto unseen, I think, is quite remarkable.
I think it's an extraordinary statistic that the largest car in the Daimler-Benz range is no longer the S-Class, but the W11 Formula One car. It's actually...
They're like tanks, aren't they?
Like, no, let's not go there. Let's not go there.
Awkward history moment.
Yeah. As John Cleese would say, don't mention the you-know-what.
And I've done a partridge.
We're not talking COVID.
But yes, remarkable car and a worthy cover star for this month's issue, I think. A fantastic job they did chasing those ghosts. I thought it was quite interesting that Lewis, you know, I think it was last season when, you know, he was cantering to the championship and Bottas wasn't really quite getting the job done. He said, well, when I'm out in front and not really being challenged, he chases ghosts like he's playing Gran Turismo, a ghost lap, chasing himself effectively around the circuit to try and improve. I didn't realise that the entire team would take that message on board and do the same thing with the car. But they have, and they've pushed it to unbelievable new heights, haven't they? Just as Ferrari has imploded, and the result is this chasm between Mercedes and the rest of the field. I think that's why this car's a bit more special than the previous record breaker, the 2018 Ferrari, because that period was a bit closer. There was a lot going on. There were multiple teams in the fight. You know, no Mercedes nor Ferrari were dominant. Obviously, there's now question marks over Ferrari's, you know, engine department during that period that subsequently called the achievement maybe into question a little bit, whereas Mercedes have, you know, categorically smashed the opposition this year with this car and moved the goalposts further on, as evidenced by that lap of Monza. So, yeah, they deserve massive congratulations.
You know what everyone's thinking? When yesterday I had a call from a company that works with one of Mercedes' sponsors, and they wanted to know, they wanted some advice on Lewis's 100th Grand Prix victory celebrations, which they want to start planning for. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, that's the mindset that people are now at when it comes to 2021, because, you know, he could do that first three races, the third race of the season next year.
If he gets the contract.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Mark's on record as saying it's a 2+1 from early this year.
I did say that, and that was I was kind of told that anyway. So
it's waiting to be signed.
I mean, he's going to be incredibly disappointed if Toto says, "I'm sorry, Sergio made me such a good offer."
He'll work for half the price.
So, when do we think that? What predictions? Let's have a little prediction. When are we going to get the announcement?
I have no idea. And, you know, on the one hand, you have the parties of the purse part saying that they could do it next March, before the first Senna style, have it on a race by race, or let's sign it when you turn up in Melbourne. And if not, I don't know, maybe Stoffel can drive, or it could be next week.
I think it'll be during the Middle East triple header, because Mercedes like to do a little Twitter drop, don't they, at some point during the race weekend. There'll be a video of Toto and Lewis shaking hands and Mock signing a contract on Twitter.
Yeah,
and
they'll
drop it on a Saturday at some point. And now the championship's done, they can go to the Middle East. Everyone's got to stay with each other for that massive period anyway. They can't travel in and out. You know, if I said you can't transit even to Abu Dhabi after the Bahrain leg, you have to do all or nothing. So basically it's get on your plane, head to Bahrain, and while you've got all that downtime, find a local branch of Chili's and thrash it out.
Yeah, without wishing to be at all derogatory about any of the venues involved, this next leg of three races is going to involve a lot of people having a lot of time on their hands. So we'll say, are you going to pin the tail on the chronological donkey there, Mark, or are you waiting for us?
I'm going to say Christmas morning. I think Lewis will just give all his fans a Christmas Day present by announcing, you know, he's...
left me a contract in my stocking.
Exactly. Bradley Lord will have a video of Toto turning up in a Santa Claus with a big sack of a big sack of money.
It might not be quite as big as it would have been, though.
A budget cap sack of money.
it could be Valtteri in a Father Christmas beard. Because, of course, there's been this worry, hasn't there? That
you're being incredibly cruel. Are you saying Toto says, Valtteri, I've got a drive for you. Could you just drop Lewis's contract?
He also wouldn't need the fake beard, because when he's demarked, you can see that Bottas has got a particular Movember stash going on at the moment, hasn't he?
He started that early, actually, didn't he? I'd say probably between Bahrain 2 and Abu Dhabi, although it would be amusing for our news cycle and keep everyone on their toes if it were, I don't know, the 20th of March or something like that, 5 minutes before the practice begins.
It's been a really bad year for sequels, isn't it? Sort of Bahrain 2, Lockdown 2. I mean, these are not sequels that any of us ever wanted to have. Top Gun 2 hasn't even launched yet because of COVID, which... he's exactly my age, as my wife keeps reminding every time I stand looking in the mirror. She says, you're the same age as Tom Cruise. And that's about the only thing you have in common.
Surely, I've been told that you've broken into the CIA vault in Langley a couple of times, dangling from wires. Shall we turn our attention to someone else who's hoping to do some break-ins? Pierre Gasly, we interview this month, and it's a nice little story, actually. Not just because, of course, Pierre's is a feel-good story, becoming a Grand Prix winner a year after being booted. But the author of our piece is a long-time reader of our magazine. He's one of our colleagues. But when he was growing up in Moscow, he used to spend his pocket money on F1 racings, as we were then, and it helped him to learn English. He'd sit there with a dictionary trying to work out what on earth we were writing about. Pierre Gasly, back as a Grand Prix winner, and seemingly back sort of finding his feet again in a team that like and respect him. And it's quite topical that we interview him now, because at the time of recording, Red Bull have yet to announce who will be in their second seat for next year. But Christian Horner has pretty much gone on record and said that it's not going to be Pierre Gasly. He's better off wherever he is now. So what do we think of that? Winning a race on merit is not enough. Christian Horner wants more.
Well, as I said earlier, I think Gasly's better off staying where he is, because he's the kind of top dog in that team at AlphaTauri. They clearly love him. He loves them. He doesn't have the white heat of the pressure that comes with being in Red Bull Racing. He doesn't need to be in a team where, I mean, let's be clear, Red Bull Racing is built around and focused on Max Verstappen, not in terms of having superior equipment or anything like that. Just there's an inherent focus in that team on Max, and quite rightly so. He's been their main man. He is their main man, and it's become a poison chalice to be the number two driver at Red Bull Racing. And so I think, you know, Christian is probably not being negative about Pierre by saying, you know, he's going to stay at AlphaTauri. He probably probably very happy to see him continue there. The question is, you know, who is going to end up with that task of lining up alongside Max every weekend and being constantly compared to him? You know, everything Alex Albon. I mean, the Alex Albon story has been, I've been really sorry, you know, it's been a sad one to follow. You know, he's gone from, you know, there's so much excitement around him and what a great job he's doing. And then all of a sudden the whole thing pivots round, and the next thing everyone's talking about the fact that Albon's in trouble and he has to save his career with a brilliant result. And again, we were talking earlier about Turkey, and, you know, there was a moment there in Turkey where it thought, oh, wow, you know, Max has made a screw up. Alex is going to grab this. My goodness, Alex Albon could win this Grand Prix. What a turnaround that would that be? And you no sooner think it than he's spun off the track as well. So Pierre, you know, I think away from the white heat of Red Bull Racing, he's found himself and also found his own, I think he's found his own voice within Formula One. He's got a great fan base. He represents that challenger brand. You know, he's there ready to upset the bigger teams. And, you know, the victory in Monza is one thing, but actually there have been plenty of other races where he's really excelled. And it's a really nice position for him to be in. And, you know, I think when you look down the line to what will happen over the next, you know, 2 or 3 years, there will be a turnover eventually at Mercedes-Benz. People like Pierre Gasly can, to some extent, bide their time, because if they can get themselves into a position where people like Toto Wolff really come to see them as an excellent choice to, you know, for the future, 2 or 3 years' time, he could find himself up and out of the Red Bull program into Mercedes-Benz if he wanted to. You know, there has to be opportunities like that unfold. Equally with Ferrari, you know, what's going to happen to Ferrari over the years? With their driver lineup, I have a kind of a slightly growing concern about what's going to happen for Carlos Sainz when he goes to Ferrari, because he's joining there at a difficult time. And, you know, how well is all of that going to work? You know, is Carlos Sainz going to end up having an amazing 5 or 7 year career at Ferrari? Or is it going to be one of those cycles that sometimes happens? You know, we mentioned Ivan Capelli earlier on in the thing. You know, is Carlos Sainz going to go to Ferrari and get what he's always dreamed of and discover it's just a complete heap? You know, he really can't deal with it for all kinds of reasons. So, you know, Mercedes, Ferrari, lots of evolution that might happen in those bigger teams. And Pierre Gasly strikes me as a guy who, if he goes to a top team again, he should go to a top team as potentially a number one driver. And that's not the Red Bull opportunity that represents that's available.
So the fact that Sainz is at Ferrari is kind of instructive, isn't it? Because he's obviously been through the Red Bull program.
Yeah.
He's then
back out
on his own through the loan deal with Renault. And now he's, you know, he's at a top team and arrived there through a different way. So, you know, obviously he's not necessarily number one driver there, but it might be possible for Gasly to follow that path. I mean, it's difficult for him to go back to Red Bull if there was an opportunity. I mean, Christian Horner mentioned that it was too soon for him anyway when they promoted him. No, they were planning on having Max and Ricciardo for longer, weren't they? And Sainz was the backup option, and they weren't really expecting to have neither of them available and then have to stick Gasly in. He was still building his experience, and it's incredibly impressive that he's been able to rebound from that disappointment from the middle of last year, string together the kind of performances and results he has strung together. And, you know, he's been one of the best standout performers this year on the grid, no doubt, and cemented his place at that team and in Formula One, hopefully for years to come. There's been talks of, you know, Renault sniffing around potentially and all sorts. So, you know, there's good momentum behind Gasly despite what's happened. But in the interim, you know, with Ricciardo leaving, Max more entrenched at Red Bull, Gasly not really working out, maybe, you know, trying a bit too hard, too much too soon, a difficult environment to go in anyway, even before you add in the Max factor and the fact that he's one of these, you know, once in a generation super talents, and what that means for the engineering direction of the car and how, you know, his driving style might be so particular that it ends up becoming one of these narrow window cars that only a few people can drive, and people like Gasly and Albon who haven't got the experience or maybe even the ultimate level of ability that someone like Max has got, they just get a bit lost. I feel like Red Bull really want it to work for Albon, but it hasn't been, like you say, Mark. And I think this speaks to the other side of, you know, this potential decline of Red Bull that we've been talking about in this podcast. The junior driver program, obviously AlphaTauri as it's known now, primarily existed as a way to blood in their younger drivers. And that's become less important because they don't have so many drivers to blood in. As the other teams have kind of got their acts together, Ferrari have a proper established driver academy now, which is funneling drivers through towards Formula One. And we might see the fruits of that shortly. Mercedes, it's not so developed, but they got in on the act and they snapped up Esteban Ocon and they're working with George Russell now. Renault have made a big part, a big play in that respect, having come back as a works team, and they've invested in youngsters in Formula 2 as they did when they were previously on the grid as a works team. So suddenly, if you're a young driver, and there are obviously less of them available now as well because it's much harder to go junior single-seater racing and much more expensive than it used to be, you've got more options. You know, it's not Red Bull for a while was the be all and end all in the Daniel Ricciardo kind of Max Verstappen era. Even it's the only game in town if you want a Formula One team to back your career and push you forward. But really, since Max, it's not really been like that. And Red Bull have had a lot of missteps as well with the drivers they have backed. There's been guys who've been kind of flirting with the upper echelons of single seater racing, and for one reason or another, it hasn't worked out. And it's slim pickings for them. So, you know, I think Daniel Kvyat would not have had a drive in the last few years if it wasn't for this situation. And arguably Red Bull are kind of just biding their time and recycling the same drivers because there isn't anyone coming up underneath ready yet to push any one of those four out. And the fact they're now finally, I think for the first time I can remember, thinking actively we need to look outside the driver pool. And it's always been forever. We push our own talent, we push youth, we give youth a chance. We're not interested in signing a big name from another team. But actually, Christian's saying, well, we've got Max, but if we want to get somebody within that 3/10 average margin that Marco mentions, we're probably going to have to sign a pair as a Hülkenberg, somebody with a bit more experience, a bit more know-how, who can get in and adapt to that car and its quirks that Verstappen is able to handle so expertly, just a little bit more quickly. And of course, if they want to be in the championship fight, they're going to need that car to score way more points. You can't have your second driver being basically one of the midfield group when the car is capable of being on the podium or potentially winning a race. So to me, it seems like inevitably, as much as, you know, I'd like Alex Albon to succeed, and as much as Red Bull seem to want him to succeed, I feel like they're going to end up plumping for either Hülkenberg or Perez at the end of the year, probably Hülkenberg. I feel like his driving style marries a bit closer to Max's naturally, and also they get on, they like each other. So I think Max would be quite happy to see Hülkenberg alongside him. He's an apolitical driver. He won't care really who he goes up against. Perez, I don't think, is quite so malleable in that sense. And when he brings sponsorship, although that is attractive to any team at this kind of juncture in the world, I think ultimately Team Harmony might be a bit better with Hülkenberg in there. And of course, you know, maybe on the absolute outside chance, if Lewis can't do his deal on Christmas Day or in Abu Dhabi or between races in Bahrain, he could rock up at Red Bull and we could have a super team alongside Max. But I doubt they'd be able to afford him.
Yeah, I don't think Toto Wolff would appreciate Christian Horner popping out of a Jack in the Box on Christmas morning. Surprise, surprise.
Hey, it's me.
It's the Grinch. I'm here to steal your Christmas.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear, you know, your kind of summary there, Ben. I would go as far as to say that Toro Rosso, now AlphaTauri, has gone from, if it ever was an assistance for them, it's now a distraction. It's actually enabled them to do things like mid-season driver changes, which in no one's book in Formula One is a great idea. It's really not that good. It's disruptive. It actually has given them opportunities to muddy the water pretty substantially at times, and no one knows where they are. And, you know, I think was it Belgium that Alex had been promoted and Pierre had been dropped back, and I remember being there and thinking, wow, you know, what a time to do it. And it felt heartless, and it felt
reactive rather than proactive.
It felt reactive, and it felt unnecessary. And it was the kind of decision where you feel, and Christian, if you're listening to the podcast, I don't know if you will be, but it felt like the kind of decision where Christian and Adrian would be sitting in Milton Keynes going, really, you know, is this what you really want to do? And you've got Helmut and Dietrich going, yeah, you know, we want to make this change, and it's the right time to do it. And it just doesn't feel like the right way to do it. With other Formula One teams, when the driver has a bad patch, you kind of work through that. And you work through that with the driver, and you try to help and support. And you know, the time to throw everything up in the air and see how it's going to fall down is not mid-season. And that didn't feel particularly helpful. And I think therefore,
it's the sort of move that you make usually when you're a team that's struggling for cash, isn't it? You change your driver mid-season because somebody's run out of money, and you need someone who's got bags of it.
What teams would possibly do that?
Definitely not Jordan Grand
Prix.
No. I don't think we did. Actually, when I was there, we didn't do too many mid-season changes. Not that I can think of, actually.
No, you were a proper team by then, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of faffing about. Well, the thing is, let's be clear. When a driver gets sent to Brixton Prison, through no fault of the team's, the team, and then you have.
Michael, there was that occasion, wasn't there?
And then apart from him.
And you've got Michael Schumacher standing on your doorstep with 150 grand from Mercedes-Benz. That kind of driver change at
did
Spa.
Did he get a decal on the car?
He was allowed to put Tic Tac on it, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Eddie Jordan's breath never was so good. That one.
Do you know what? I can't help but visualize what these conversations might be like in Christian Horner's office. Do you remember the cartoon Stop the Pigeon, where of course Dick Dastardly and Muttley were in their aeroplane chasing after this carrier pigeon that had the whatever messages it was that they wanted to intercept, and inevitably, you know, some mishap would occur, they would fail, and then, you know, the old-fashioned telephone would ring in the cockpit, and Dick Dastardly would pick it up, and he'd go, "Yes, General," and you'd hear this, "Yes, General." I kind of can't help but think that that's what happens in Christian Horner's office. You know, there's the old style telephone. Yes, Dietrich, because it's the hotline. And, oh, Helmut, yes. Of course we'll fire him. You know, it could just be like that. Shall we round up by talking about perhaps Red Bull's forward engine options? Because you covered
the other problem.
The other problem with Red Bull. Engines.
No engines. Yeah, bit of a problem. As you quite rightly, have pointed out, Stuart, they don't have much of a soft spot for Cosworth, and this is kind of comes under my the point I was making, that when you look at all of Mercedes-Benz competition, they all have fundamental structural issues, and Red Bull's structural issue is that they don't have control over their engine program. They had this torrid affair with Renault where, you know, they won four world championships but somehow managed to fall out spectacularly, to the extent that Renault went and bought their own team back again. And then
rather than have any further dealings with them.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, they've gone and done the right thing at Red Bull in terms of getting into bed with Honda, but Honda have just been demonstrating a huge inability to grasp what's involved in doing Formula One properly. They came in prematurely, albeit they were convinced by McLaren to come in prematurely. They came in prematurely, didn't understand how much the technology had moved on, then spent that entire McLaren relationship playing catch up. And now at the moment where they finally break through and win, you know, the guys in head office decide, okay, well, actually, we're not going to do Formula One anymore because we, you know, we're going to invest in environmental technologies rather than staying in Formula One and helping Formula One to transition away from fossil fuels and develop the very technologies which could benefit Honda in the long term. I have to say, the Honda decision is shocking, and it shows that the senior people in Honda in Japan have completely forgotten everything that Sakura Honda, deployed in when he created that company. Racing improves the breed. You know, going to the Isle of Man TT to prove the capability of Honda motorcycles, coming into Formula One in the 1960s, they've forgotten all of that because they don't know how to do it properly. And then because they don't know how to do it properly, every evolution that Honda has in Formula One involves playing catch up, and then they disappear again. And it's really shocking. It really is shocking. And I have a good friend who had a senior role at Honda in motorsport, not in Formula One. And you know, I remember him telling me a couple of years ago, he said they won't stay. He said they'll be gone in a year or two. He said they don't actually know why they're in Formula One. They don't really know how to do it. There's a lot of politics involved, and this is not part of their DNA anymore. It's something they kind of drift in and out of. So
famously flaky, aren't they?
Red Bull are really victims of that sort of Honda, you know, Honda approach. And so Red Bull themselves, more than ever, now need to think about their future in Formula One. This is why I do worry about them, because if they have a big enough thought process about that, they might question why they're going to bother continuing in Formula One. Because the reality is that the complexity of the cars required today and the likely complexity of the cars required going forward, particularly if we move into a synthetic fuel formula post 2025 in terms of, you know, engines running on synthetic fuels, etc., the powertrain is going to remain a fundamental piece of technology that you either have in-house or you have an incredibly long-term partnership with someone externally, and it needs to be top-level, not customer relationship. And Adrian Newey must realize that, and Christian Horner must realize that. And the fact that, you know, Dr. Marco doesn't like Cosworth, which we know about, you know, it's some kind of bizarre notion he has about Cosworth based on their original engagement with them back when they bought Jaguar Racing, you know, is really unfortunate, because the solutions are staring them in the face that they could easily come up with effectively a works Red Bull engine. And as I say, the AlphaTauri team to me feels like a distraction. I know Red Bull have always taken the approach, we don't want to be in the engine business. We don't want to own an engine company. Dietrich doesn't have any interest in owning an engine company. Well, he had interest in owning an engineering company called a Formula One team. He had an interest in buying the Formula One team. And the thing I really don't understand is when Red Bull as a company do anything, they do it really well. They own it. You know, if you look at what he's done in football with RB Leipzig, you know, he comes in and he does football properly and he just goes and he wants to win. And yet in Formula One, the Formula One team has now had one hand tied behind its back for the last 8 years. And they can't fight like that. They need to have an engine program that they have complete control over, and not do it in a half-baked way. And of course, and there are ways they could do it that they could make money out of it. I have no doubt about that, because if you did a good enough job, Red Bull could effectively become a new engine provider within Formula One and sell power units to other people. I mean, we made money on that at Cosworth. When I was running Cosworth in 2010, 11, 12, we were making good money on selling engine technology. And by the way, that was even just with one customer, we could make a profit. So I think, you know, there's a lot to think about, but let's hope that Red Bull come up with a solution soon. I've mentioned in my column the fact that they have a solution potentially closer to home in the form of AVL, which is an Austrian powertrain company who happen to be based in Graz in Austria, which is Helmut Marko's hometown. But there are lots of other options out there as well. The fact that Honda are prepared to offer the intellectual property of the powertrain to Red Bull, effectively grant them that, is terrific. And I think probably the only thing you can say about Honda that's good is that every time they quit Formula One, they hand everything over to someone else who then goes and does a better job. So they hand, you know, they handed their Formula One team over to Ross Brawn at the end of 2008. He went and won the championship in 2009. So actually, if they hand the engines over to Red Bull, who knows? Maybe Red Bull will find a partner who can take them onto the next level and they go and win the title in 2022.
Time is running out for that, though, isn't it? Because they're going to have to define the envelope, as it were, of the 2022 car within the next few months once the rules are actually settled. Because that's another thing, isn't it? The 2022 rules, what were going to be coming in 2021, are still not settled. So we'll see very much what happens over the winter in terms of firming those up. And that was another little takeaway from my interview with John Owen that I don't think we had room for in the Mercedes feature, as was that he said that actually they're pretty glad that those rules didn't come in for 2021, because they were half-baked was not the phrase he chose. But given that we're in lockdown again, we're doing a lot of baking, half-baked is the turn of phrase we'll use.
Surely not in Formula One. Nothing's half-baked, is it?
It's half-baked. So they should be properly baked.
but Red Bull are facing Hobson's choice, really, aren't they? Because they tried to get Mercedes engines and were rebuffed, and they certainly won't get them now. No one wants a Ferrari engine, even if they're offered a Ferrari engine. And Renault might be forced to supply them by regulation, but we've already covered how disastrously that partnership ended, and I don't think either party has a desire to get back into bed. I mean, Renault might take the money, but it's certainly not going to be a winning unity in the level of cooperation that is required. So really, short of a new manufacturer coming in, which Formula One is obviously desperate for but isn't going to get, certainly not until these new synthetic cheaper hybrid rules come in, maybe in 2026, Red Bull has to make this work. They have to get the Honda IP, and they have to do something with that IP. I mean, it seems to me they're getting their heads around this, and having previously always said no, we have no interest in doing our own engines, they're now saying actually maybe we do want to do our own engines, this might be the right thing. But of course they want to do it as cheaply as possible, because they're absolutely, it seems to me, frightened of the potential investment required to do it properly. So they want everything frozen as is, so they can just take the Honda engine, rebadge it, run it and be competitive, and they want their competitors frozen in similar fashion, so Formula One doesn't become an engine development game, at least until the new fuel rules come in. But whether they get their way or not, I don't know. I think I agree with you, Mark. I don't, given the other options are so limited or poor, I think they just have to bite the bullet and be positive about it. And who knows, if they can do a really good job, like you say, if you can make money off of one customer deal, then you're sitting pretty, aren't they?
We have more to come in next month's issue, and I dare say, because of that, in next month's podcast, you will have another couple of soapboxes to climb onto, Mark, because in next month's issue, you will be producing a feature for us on how not to do Formula One. And as Formula One looks towards a 23 race calendar next year, featuring a race in Saudi Arabia towards the end, your column, which is an absolute humdinger, which you've already filed, takes that thorny issue into account. So we've got that to look forward to next month. There's plenty more to read in this month's GP Racing. So look out for us the next time you're making an essential journey to the supermarket or a reputable newsagent. Mark takes a look at Formula One's new boss. Richard Williams' fabulous series on F1's 70 greatest influencers comes to a close. And Now That Was a Car examines the Brabham BT33, Sir Jack's last Grand Prix winner. This has been a podcast brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Other podcasts are available covering all sorts of racing on two wheels and four. Check out gpracing.com for the latest subscription offers. And thank you to Ben Anderson.
Thank you, Codders. Always a pleasure.
And thank you to Sir Mark Gallagher, as it says. Well,
thank you. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to have been part of this great, wonderful program today, Stuart.
Never was a sincerer sentence spoken on this podcast.
It's very rare we end one of these podcasts by saying, good luck finding a way to edit an end into this one, Martin.
We sincerely apologise.
We've excelled ourselves this month. Anyway, Thanks for listening. We will be back next month with another Flat Chat.